The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
Look at it, it's so cute.
The terrible Australian, Bea Jamine.
As Nicolas Cage, I should have played Tom Sawyer in this movie. But then they asked me and I was like, that's too typical of a role. I actually want to play the role of the submarine.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
That was a at the time.
Mature themes.
I mean, if the octopus in Aquaman can do it, so can Adam Sandler.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome back to the Super Podcast, the flagship show here at the Super Network. And this is episode 162, and I am your trusty co-host, Super Marcy. So thank you, everybody, and welcome. And I'm joined with my co-host, my usual co-host anyway, haven't left him behind. Please welcome the terrible Australian, Bea Jamine. Hello, Bea. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing good, doing good. And yes, for this episode, it is just the two of us.
I know, it's weird. It's been a while since it has been just the two of us, or should I say, just the two of us. Oh, wait, sorry. But it has been a while since we have recorded with just the two of us. But anyways, not going into the song again. With only us two, I should say, because it has been a while. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the little topic we have come up for this episode tonight.
Yes, indeed. So for today's episode, Bede and I are doing a movie swap. So basically what that entails is Bede gives me a film that he has seen, but I have not, and vice versa. I give Bede a film I've seen, but he hasn't seen. So the aim is for each of us to swap a film that we both like, and the other gets to see a film they haven't seen before and obviously decide, I guess, if they liked it or not, if we got the recommendations correct. And moving forward, we will be keeping up this topic, and that will be available about monthly over on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/thesupernetwork. And a week later, it'll go up exclusively on YouTube as video. So keep an eye out next month for the next movie swap. But for today's episode of Movie Swap, we kind of didn't really have a theme, but it ended up kind of having a bit of a religious theme with our films.
Indeed.
So, yeah. So, Bede, what film did you give me?
Well, Marcy, I thought for this episode, because I've been actually kind of recommending you to check out this pick for a while now, and I thought since we were doing a little mini movie swap episode, I thought it would be finally a good chance for you to watch this film. And that, of course, is the 2015 psychological horror film, The Black Coat's Daughter, or as it's also known by February.
Hey, Dad, just calling to see where you and Mom are, if you're coming.
Worst case, they come on Friday and everyone goes home and has a really nice break. After all, we can't let you live here.
But you know about the sisters, don't you? They worship the devil.
Catherine, is there something wrong?
Why are you doing this?
Do you believe in God, Joan? Ever tried to look for him? I look for him in the unlikely things that happen. Little coincidences.
Deedle, deedle, black coat's daughter, what was in the holy water?
Is something funny? You smiled a little.
Funny? No. Why? I mean, I just wish you could stay and see my performance. That's all.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So we will get right on to discussing the pick that you've given me.
Mm-hmm.
Since you did give me this film, I will read out the synopsis and all of that stuff. The Black Coat's Daughter, aka February, synopsis from IMDb. Two girls must battle a mysterious evil force when they get left behind at their boarding school over winter break. The film was written and directed by Oz Perkins, who I believe is the son of Anthony Perkins.
Indeed.
Yes, I was quite intrigued by that. And the film stars Emma Roberts, Kiernan Shipka, I think?
I believe so, yes.
I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. Lucy Boynton, James Remar, Lauren Holly, Greg Elwand, Elena Kroskus, I think, and Heather Todd Mitchell. I apologize if I got any names wrong. So, Bede, as you mentioned, you've been wanting me to see this film for a while. So out of all the films you could have given me for a movie swap, what is it about this one that you really wanted me to see it?
Well, first of all, I think for all of our listeners out there where I first heard of The Black Coat's Daughter, I think I first became aware of this film when I believe in 2015 it played at the Toronto International Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And at the time, like, it got a lot of really good buzz, but what did make me very interested to check it out was that it was the directorial debut of Oz Perkins, or Osgood Perkins as he's known in the credits, who's the son of Anthony Perkins. And this was his directorial debut, and for many years he was an actor. So I was kind of very curious by that, but then when I heard from people say that it had a lot of comparisons to Robert Eggers' film The Witch in terms of that kind of slow build horror, and I was even more intrigued to check it out. But the film didn't actually get released until 2 years later. It kind of did more of the film circuit. Once it finally did, I added it to my 31 Days of Horror list that year. Like, I had a feeling that I was going to enjoy the film based on what I read. But when I actually sat down and watched it, I was actually quite blown away from this film. Like, I kind of went into this film blind. Like, I kind of knew the basic premise where it, of course, it was about these two girls who were left behind at this Catholic boarding school and something supernatural happens. But what I think is very interesting about this film is it's a very interesting and unique take on the exorcism film or the possession film.
Yeah.
There's a lot more going on with this film in terms of its approach, and it also deals with some very interesting and universal themes at the center of it. And also it takes a very interesting approach with how it constructs the story. Like a tale, well, at first you don't realize that it's actually a non-linear structure. For a while you don't realize that until about halfway through, where a plot turn happens, which we'll go into a little bit in a second, and then it just sort of takes the film in a completely, it sort of, I guess you could say, it sort of adds another layer to the film that you don't expect. And as it goes along, it becomes even more unnerving and creepy and immersive. And then strangely, once it gets to the end of the film, after all the horrific things that happens, it ends on such a heartbreaking note. Once you kind of sort of realize why that is, it actually ends it on a much more interesting and compelling note than another film like this would have done if it was in another person's hands. But I think Osgood Perkins kind of does a really interesting and unique job with this film while creating a film that is incredibly atmospheric, incredibly unnerving. And a lot of times it did remind me of the tone of the original Exorcist film. I watched this and I absolutely loved it. And I think I put down that final shot of the film as some of my favorite shots from a horror film in recent years. And every time I post that shot in anything, like, most people don't get the context of that shot, but people who I know who do have seen the movie, they just go, oh yeah, that's a perfect shot, like, from that film. But I kind of knew that this would be a film that would appeal to you in a lot of ways, because it's a film with a lot of female protagonists. It deals with demonic possession. It sort of said it has a religious theme throughout. And it's also incredibly dark and unique story that finds an interesting way to take a subgenre that we've seen many times before and does a different kind of spin on it. that feels very fresh. So I kind of knew that this would be the perfect film for you. But that being said, though, I am curious, Marcy, what did you think of The Black Coat's Daughter, a.k.a. February?
I thought it was terrible. Why did you recommend this movie? No, I'm kidding.
No!
No, I'm kidding. You do know me very well. You know what kind of films I like. And usually when you recommend me something, chances are I will like it, because you wouldn't really recommend me something you know I'm not going to like, unless you're just trying to be a jerk bag. But that's understandable. but no, this is definitely a very Marcy kind of film, because it is really like this dark and unsettling film. And then you have the religious themes, you have the demonic possession stuff, but then this interesting, like, non-linear way of telling the story, that it gives you all these clues that if you work it out, you kind of will understand, like, where the film's going. But at first, it isn't quite so obvious. So you do kind of have your thinking cap on and stuff like that. But it the kind of, like, unsettling vibes I got from it was kind of like maybe David Lynch's Lost Highway, which is probably a very weird comparison, but it just kind of had that dread and unnerving feeling that I kind of got when I watched that. And it really is quite a unique and different film in terms of demonic possession, because it's not quite like the center of the film. There's a lot more going on with that. So it's not like you know what's happening straight away, which I think was pretty cool. In terms of the film. And so, yeah, it was quite very different with that. And then when you have different characters and you're following on their stories and you try to unravel what's going on, and just everything that happens just leaves you very unsettled, because you know something bad is going to happen. So I was really impressed by a lot of the atmosphere and the mood, and how the slow build kind of really works, and how the non-linear structure actually really worked as well. Like, it wasn't overly difficult to follow or anything. And I think overall it is a pretty damn solid film.
Indeed. And I think what I love a lot about this film is that it's very ambiguous in its approach. Like, you're never quite sure that if everything that is happening to the character of Kat in this film, played by Kieran Shipka, is like all in her head, because from the very beginning of the film you can definitely tell she's a very detached young teenage girl, and who has this kind of dream or premonition that her parents have been killed in a car crash. But the thing is that in these dreams is an unseen figure wearing a black coat, and then of course that kind of unsettles her. But then she kind of has this odd kind of behavior, and at first you're not exactly sure, like, well, one of the, I guess, the most compelling things about the film is, like, is everything that is happening and everything that she is doing, is this all in her head, or is she suffering from some kind of mental illness? Or is she, in fact, because of her kind of detachment, her being isolated, and the fact that she's an incredibly lonely person, was this, like, the perfect reason for a demonic spirit to possess her body and to commit very horrific acts in the film? And I think the film does find that line between, you can choose either way, like how, like what is happening in the story is actually happening or not. I think for me personally, I like to think that what was happening actually did happen, like she was possessed, mainly because of little things I noticed on this second watch. Felt to me like, oh yeah, she really was possessed by a demon, or at least was in service of one. And I think the performances are fantastic across the board. Kieran Shipka, who's kind of had quite a big career since this film. And I guess at this point, she's best known as playing John Hamm's daughter in Mad Men at this time. I thought she was really great. And also Lucy Boynton was also great in the role of Rose. And then, of course, you have, I guess, well, one of the biggest stars in the film, Emma Roberts. But what I think is great about her performance in particular, because since the film, for the first half, you don't realize is this kind of non-linear story. You think that Emma Roberts' character is a completely different character who's also on her way to that school for her own kind of reasons. Since pretty much how Osgood Perkins kind of sets up a lot of these scenes, it's like everything that's happening with Rose and Kat is at night, and also the same things as it's also happening at night with the character of Joan, in quotes, Joan, with Emma Roberts' character. Then, of course, she meets an older married couple, played by James Remar and Lauren Holly. And you kind of think, okay, so this is a married couple. Maybe this might be Kat's parents or Rose's parents that are on their way to, because they met, and they're on their way to the town of Brampton, which in my research, I realized that the school named after is called Brampton. And Brampton was also the name of the building in Rosemary's Baby.
Oh.
So you think, okay, but then you kind of realize that the scenes with James Remar and Lauren Holly and Emma Roberts are actually set 9 years after the events of Rose and Kat. And then we discovered that Rose has died. Of course, again, with Joan, she's not sure how she deals with this. Like, she laughs inappropriately when she finds out that their daughter has died. But then you realize, of course, that she's the older version of Kat, who escaped a mental asylum, murdered someone, took over their name, and is on their way back to the same school. But then when you kind of realize the reason why, like, it's pretty terrifying. But at the same time, once we kind of go into the third act of the story and find out the reason why Kat is doing what she's doing, it kind of is very creepy, but also kind of heartbreaking as well. Because I think what's interesting, when you read what I was reading up on the film, Osgood Perkins did say that he wanted to do a film that was about loss and grief, but use the horror genre as a Trojan horse to explore those themes. And I think what he does really well is, because you and I have seen a lot of films about demonic possession or exorcism.
Yeah.
And usually when something like that happens, like once the demon's kind of out of that person's life, they're really happy and joyful and goes on. But this is one of the rare instances in a film. And I think what is so unique about it is that Kat kind of welcomes the demon into her life because it's almost like she's finally got a friend or someone who she feels alone.
She's not alone anymore.
Yeah.
And when we actually see like what happened and stuff, like after she commits murders at the school and she's in the hospital and the priest comes and performs an exorcism, and it's really the last thing she wants. She does not want that demon to be gone, but the exorcism is successful and the demon is out, and clearly she could not deal with not having that presence with her anymore.
Yeah, and then, of course, and again, this is a spoiler podcast, so apologies for all of our listeners if we're revealing too much, but if you haven't seen this film, definitely go check it out anyway.
Well, there is a disclaimer in the intro that says spoiler alert. So.
Exactly. But I think what she kind of thinks is like, oh, if I go back there, I can try to find the demon again. And, of course, she ends up brutally murdering Rose's parents. Takes their severed heads to the basement where she was talking to the demon. But when she gets there, she realizes the place is cold. There's nothing there. No sign of anyone or anything of the demon. And it kind of hits both her and also the audience. Is like, she is now fully, truly alone. She has no one, nothing. Her parents are gone. This demon who she felt like kind of brought some fulfillment in her life is kind of gone. And even though in a lot of other films like this, you would think, oh, you know, the demon's gone, you know, that horrible thing's gone forever. You don't have to worry about it anymore. But the fact that this film kind of shows like she needed that demon in her life, even though, yeah, she did horrible, truly horrific things. But you can't help but feel some kind of empathy for her in that final shot of the film.
It kind of does. It makes you feel sorry for a character that, you know, has killed people.
Yeah.
And killed people rather brutally. But as you kind of see the development of the character when obviously like her parents have been killed and she doesn't find out straight away, that's why they didn't pick her up at school and she's left there. So you kind of see a little bit of who she is, and maybe she kind of had some, I don't know, something for, was it Rose?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether she wanted her as a friend or something, like she definitely has a connection that she felt, but obviously it just nothing materialized. And then, you know, she does those killings, and as you realize, like, oh, Joan is actually Kat just ahead in time, and that this is looking back. Like, you get hints of it when you're in sort of like more Joan's point of view, when you see flashbacks, and you kind of get hints that that is the same person. But I don't think it quite hits you until you find out, like, when she's talking to the James Remar character and he says, oh, our daughter died, and he shows the photo, when you click back to who that is, you're kind of like, oh, so someone's getting killed, and could this be that person? Or, and you kind of understand, like, what's happening as it goes on. But it definitely is a film about, like, loss and grief. And I would say, I guess, of just, even though she didn't quite, she thought, like, yeah, her parents had been killed because she had that dream, and that's obviously what happened. She just felt, like, so, so alone that, I don't know where I was going with this kind of conversation. she's feels like she's lost everything, as where I was going. Like, that loneliness gets to her so much that, yeah, it's almost like she's grieving not being, or at least being, completely alone. And when she has that final realization at the end, you do feel something for her, and you probably shouldn't, because, again, knowing that she's, like, brutally killed people, and, yeah, they were brutal. It does show you things, but it doesn't take away from the film at all, nothing like that.
Yeah, and I think even though, yeah, when it does show the violence, it is very hard-hitting and unsettling, and it comes out of nowhere. Like, it just sort of happens in such a brutal, realistic way that you can't help but be unnerved by the whole situation, just due to how, you know, how believable of a situation that Perkins creates with this entire world that this story takes in.
Yeah. And, yeah, as you said, the performances are all really great. Like, I thought everyone did a really good, and they're very believable. There's definitely a point where it does kind of click, because the two actresses kind of do look a bit similar. So you can see that, oh shit, yeah, that could be the older version. Like, I think that's actually really well done. And I think even, like, very specifically, it was the hair where it really clicked for me, when I was looking at their hair, and I'm like, oh shit, it's actually the same person. That was kind of my realization. But yeah, I thought this was such a well-made and really intriguing and unsettling film. It was a very good choice. Very happy I've seen it. So definitely thank you for the movie pick, Pete.
Indeed, indeed. And I'm glad you really much enjoyed this one. I had a feeling you would, but I wasn't sure. But then again, we can never be too sure. But I'm glad you enjoyed this one, because I think it does have a lot of interesting things in it. And like I say, it's kind of an interesting kind of spin on the Exorcist film.
Yeah, it's very different for, like, a demonic possession kind of film. And even there is an exorcism in it, but it doesn't last long. And knowing, like, that's not what the person wanted, like, would the better thing have been to leave that person with a demon, or would they just continue to kill? Like, it's so hard to say what the right course of action was, which I think is another interesting aspect of the film.
Yeah, and also, like, Osgood Perkins, like, when it comes to the film's more scary, creepy moments, he does take a much more subtle approach to the film. And I think that's another thing that I love about the film, is the subtle approach he brings to the film.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's done really well, and I think to get that amount of, like, really unnerving atmosphere is a damn good job.
Exactly.
Indeed.
Exactly. And now that I know that you like this film, Marcy, I'll be very curious to hear of his follow-up films, I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and Gretel and Hansel, which I think were just maybe not quite on the level of Black Coat's Daughter, but still really good, interesting, and atmospheric horror films.
Maybe one day I will check them out. And as we usually do when we discuss films, we will give our rating. So my rating for this film is... So my rating is 4 out of 5 really weird demonic possessions. It's a really, really good film, and something that I would highly recommend horror peeps to check out.
Indeed. I'm going to go all the way with this one, Marcy. I'm giving this 5 out of 5.
Well...
which is my highest rating for a horror film. And I don't really give that rating out much to many horror films, even though I give that rating out a lot. but when it comes to the horror genre, I'm very picky about what I give 5 stars to. So this one kind of blew me away when I saw it back in 2017. And I think after it was my second favorite horror film of that year. But yeah, it's a great horror film, a very, I would say, just a perfect little gem of a film, and one that I think more people should check out because not really that many people talk about it. And I think it's a really good one that more of our audience or even just horror fans should check this one out, especially if you love a good slow burn horror film.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So what did I give Bede?
Indeed.
Well, I gave Bede the 1947 film Black Narcissus.
This is the story of a high endeavor that tried and tested a woman in the remote background of Asia. The story of a prince and a beggar maid, and of a nun who gave up her vows.
Why should we want to keep you here against your will? Because you're all jealous of me. Especially you.
The clash of strong personalities.
I understood you wanted to see me.
We want to talk to you on business.
I suppose you want to talk to me on anything else. Sorry.
I don't know why you are being so rude to me, Mr. Dean. I have to talk business with you, whether I like it or not.
The contrast of present peace and self-denial with the rich memories of the full years that have passed. They renounced the world of men, but found that the world was not to be denied.
I gave up my vows. I finished with them up there.
I see.
I love you.
You...
I had to have the young general. I couldn't turn out the holy man. I couldn't stop the wind from blowing and the air from being as clear as crystal, and I couldn't hide the mountain.
I told you it was no place to put a nunnery. There's something in the atmosphere that makes everything seem exaggerated. Don't you understand?
So, Bede, since this is the film that I gave you, why don't you give us the synopsis and all that good stuff?
Indeed. Well, Black Narcissus was written and directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, and it was based on the novel of the same name by Ruma Gotted. And the film stars Deborah Carr, Sabu, David Farrar, Flora Robson, Esmond Knight, Gene Simmons, and Kathleen Byron. And the plot summary, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a group of nuns struggle to establish a convent in the Himalayas, while isolation, extreme weather, altitude, and culture clashes all conspire to drive the well-intentioned missionaries mad. Now, Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Black Narcissus, and why did you pick this film for me?
Okay, so, yeah, after seeing The Red Shoes many years ago, which is Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger film. I believe it was before Black Narcissus.
I believe so.
So yeah, after being just blown away by The Red Shoes, I wanted to check out more of their stuff. And Black Narcissus was one that was highly recommended. And I believe I think I found the Blu-ray at Big W. Mm-hmm. One day. It's the most odd place to find a Blu-ray. So having sat and watched it, like, I just thought that this was another incredible film. I think I do like The Red Shoes a bit better, but this is still just, I think it's a masterpiece of cinema. And it goes from just how the story's told, the visuals, the atmosphere it creates, just how amazingly beautifully shot it is. And there's just so many things that are so pristine. Like, I think it's paced incredibly well. As you kind of go through and you learn about what's happening, the story, so you've got the nuns and you introduce to who they are, kind of how they're dealing with the situation and the things that happened around them, like with the people that are there and the culture clashes and everything like that. And then it just leads to this very sad and very confronting ending that just leaves you very, very sad. And there's a lot of different kind of things you can take away from the film in terms of themes and all of that. And looking on your list of films that you own but haven't seen, and I think I was completely shocked. I thought you had seen this film, and realizing you hadn't, I'm like, Bede, how could you not have seen just one of the most just stunning looking films, just something that is just so kind of mesmerizing. So that was my thought process behind giving you this film. But Bede, did you like my pick of film for you?
Marcy, it was terrible. Oh, no way. No, wait, it wasn't. well, actually, before I go into my thoughts, I just discovered Black Narcissus actually came out before The Red Shoes.
Oh, before The Red Shoes. Okay.
Well, The Red Shoes came out literally right after this one.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I tend to get confused with what came out first. So
that's all right. Yeah. Well, I think for, like, Powell and Pressburger, I've started to really find them some of the most interesting duo filmmaking. Like, I've seen The Red Shoes, and at the time I thought it was like a good film. I didn't love it as much as, say, you or other people I know. But to be fair, shameful. That was like 12, 13 years ago, so I might have.
Shameful Bede.
But I might appreciate it a lot more on a rewatch, because I haven't seen it since then. But I have kind of started watching their other work since then. Well, Michael Powell, as a solo director, he made Peeping Tom,
which
I thought was a fantastic film. And then during the lockdown, I saw two other films of theirs that I think a lot of people consider up there as their best work, which, of course, is The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp and A Matter of Life and Death.
They're two that are on my Hall of Shame list of films I haven't seen yet, so I'm definitely keen to watch more, for sure.
Yeah, and they're both fantastic films. And I think, because usually every year I've done this like top 10 older films I've seen in like that particular year. I've been doing it for a few years now, and I believe Colonel Blimp was my pick as the best older film I saw that year.
Oh, yeah.
And Matter of Life and Death, I think, might have been in the top 5 or maybe top 7. And I've had Black Narcissus for a while now, because a lot of people have recommended me this film. Our good friend of the show, Sam Inglis, recommended this film to me a while back. And I think during one of the Criterion sales, I was like looking for films to pick up. And usually I mix it up with picking, you know, films I've seen before and love and want to get the Criterion for, or have a couple of blind buys in there. So I finally picked up Black Narcissus. And when you pick this film for the show, I thought, finally, I could just watch this film.
And you needed that excuse, and you finally had it.
Exactly, exactly. And I got to say, Marcy, I absolutely loved this film.
You're welcome, Bede. You're welcome. See, I know how to pick them for you.
Exactly. And it's kind of interesting now. We really picked these two films quite well, because there's a lot of similarities between the two of them, even though they are different genres.
Because you can look at it like there's a lot of psychological stuff. There's stuff with isolation and loneliness and not wanting to be alone and all that stuff. Like and the religious elements, of course, there's definitely quite a few things in common. So we figured, yeah, this may be a bit of a religion theme going on here.
Indeed. And also you have two female characters, one of them starting to go a bit mad as well. Yeah, well, I wasn't sure what to expect from Black Narcissus when I sat down to watch it. The only kind of thing I knew, again, it's about nuns, and me being from a Catholic background, anything to do with religion, I'm definitely going to sit down and watch. And also, it's them starting up a convent that's going to be more of a school and a hospital for the local villagers and that in the Himalayas. But what really struck me the most was like one of the shots from the film, and it's probably one of the most famous shots of the film, is when one of the characters, and I believe it's Deborah Carr's character, whose name is, and I've got the Wikipedia page up, but not on the character page, so I apologize.
She's Sister Clodagh, Deborah Kerr.
Sister Clodagh. And there's like this bell on the side of a cliff near the palace where they've set up the convent. And when she's doing that, you see a shot and it shows the entire valley and just how high up that cliff is. And it's so, but the thing is, like, even though, yes, it's a matte painting and it's a beautiful matte painting, there's a lot of beautiful matte paintings throughout this film. But at the same time, though, even though it is a matte painting, you still can't help but feel so much vertigo seeing yeah. this shot because it's shot down. Mm. And I get vertigo a lot. And yeah. so watching that scene, I just felt that in the scene.
Yeah, but I being, feel ya.
Being that it is a Powell and Pressburger film,
mm.
And this is like a trademark of all their films, you know for a fact that since they've shot this film in Technicolor, it's going to be, mm. visually, it's going to be absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and it doesn't hold back at all. Like, the scene with all the flowers in the field, mm. like, it's gorgeous. You look at it today and you think this was made like almost like 70 something plus years ago. Like, it's an it looks incredible.
Oh yeah,
it's honestly a fucking beautiful looking movie.
Yeah,
the matte paintings are gorgeous. Like, the use of them works so well. Yeah. I'll let you continue.
Yeah, and even though, like, yeah, you sort of now know, like, oh, it's obviously matte paintings, but for mm. me though, it kind of adds an interesting feel to the film, like a different type of layer to it, almost like a sort mm. of a fantastical feel to
yeah.
the film. And but what I think is really interesting about this film is, like, you've got these group of nuns
mm.
who come from civilization to go live at this mm. convent. And the only thing we kind of really knew is that a year prior, a group of monks tried to set up a monastery yeah. there, but they left pretty quickly. And
there's a line in the film that says, like, they didn't make it to monsoon season.
Mm.
And then we kind of see that repeat itself at the end of this film, which it's almost this very, like, poetic thing that you see, like, it's the start of that monsoon season as they're leaving.
Yeah, and also, like, what I think is interesting about this film is, like, they pretty much, you know, have their own kind of lives. They're pretty normal. They have no problems in the world. But once they get to this location and how isolated and also how sort of claustrophobic and trapped it feels, it starts to affect them all in different ways.
Mm.
Like, Sister Clowder, played by Deborah Carr, she starts to reminisce about a past love that she had for a man. But the thing is, we find out is, like, that man did not love her back. Mm. And because of that, when she found out about that, she left everything behind, including being yeah. part of a rich family to become a nun. But then we kind of see how it all the different sisters kind of deal with this situation. And they are all affected in different ways.
Mm.
You got one sister in particular who starts to get more emotionally involved with helping out, you know, the local yeah. villagers by, even though, like, it is said to, like, not really give them too much medicine, because if something goes wrong, the villagers will blame the convent for all the horrible things that have happened. And so she gives cough medicine to a sick baby, and the baby dies due to too much of it, which the town pretty much ostracizes the nun.
Yeah.
And then you got another one who's meant to be making, like, a vegetable patch and all that, but for some reason, and even she can't explain, she ends up, like, just growing a flower garden for no reason, and she's not sure why. And then, of course, one of the most interesting characters in the entire film is, of course, Sister Ruth, played by Kathleen Byron, and who is absolutely fantastic in the film.
Everyone is incredible, but specifically her and Deborah Carr, like, wow.
Mm. Their dynamic is fantastic, but what's interesting about, you know, Sister Ruth is, out of all the different sisters, like, she's the one at least we get an idea of what she's like beforehand, because when Deborah Carr at first doesn't want to take it because, like, she's kind of the more unruly of the sisters at the nunnery. And also, she's been dealing with personal problems as well. But once she goes to this new convent, like, it starts to affect her psychologically, and she starts to become obsessed with one of the with the character of Mr. Dean, who's kind of like the liaison between the nuns and also the local villagers. And she starts to become romantically interested in him, and thinks that Sister Clodagh, who kind of forms a bond with Mr. Dean, like, she thinks, like, oh, there's something romantic going on. Mm. And Sister Ruth, basically, she wants to throw away her vows and everything just to be with this man. But what I love about it is, like, it's an absolutely fantastic performance from Kathleen Byron. And the interesting thing is, though, because, like, this is a drama, like, it's a psychological drama.
Yeah.
But when we kind of see Sister Ruth's descent into madness in the third act of the film, at times it almost felt like it was a horror film.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it because of just how well it's done and how utterly just almost sad and horrifying that the situation's become.
And it kind of makes you think, like, why is all this happening? Is this something that was kind of deeply buried and now they're in this far away from civilization and are in this isolated place? Is this all this stuff kind of bringing itself to the surface? Or is it, and again, kind of in an ambiguous way, is it the area itself kind of coaxing all this stuff out of it? Because, like, the local villagers have their own kind of spiritual beliefs of the area. And also there's a holy man who kind of oversees the valley that this convent is in. And he never talks throughout the whole movie. He just sits there and says and kind of takes in everything that is happening in this valley on a spiritual level. And it kind of makes you think, like, is all this stuff, again, being brought to the surface for all these nuns because of, you know, where they are? Or is there something, like, going on in the area that's kind of coaxing this stuff to come out and also feel like they're not wanted there and they should leave? And it's an interesting thing that you could say has a subtext to colonialism in a way.
Yeah, oh, definitely, because you had that that rule in that area at the time. And I think, I'm not sure if it was around the time this film came out or maybe just before or something, but that's where they left the area.
Yeah.
I would have to look it up, but I'm not sure because I did read it. But yeah, I'm not quite sure. So someone might have to look that up for me. or you can just do research yourself. But I think it's kind of, definitely speaks to that and kind of almost invading, you know, a place and not really wanting to, like that area, just understanding you shouldn't be there kind of thing. Like, I think that's what we... I guess that's kind of one of the subtexts, what I'm trying to get at with the film. But yeah, it's possibly around the time or something that rule left. So
yeah, well, according to this, I'm looking on Wikipedia now. It says here, Black Narcissus was released only a few months after India achieved independence from Britain in August 1947.
There you go. So it was around that time. So the film almost has that feeling like they're kicking them out. They weren't wanted there kind of thing. And it definitely speaks to that colonialism and the, you know, that white savior complex they seem to have. I do think that Powell and Pressburger definitely knew what they were doing. And the themes that I've noticed in their films, like they're very serious things. They're very thought provoking, but the way that everything is crafted is just so beautifully done.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's beautifully written. It's beautifully filmed. The performances, as you say, are just fantastic. Deborah Carr is amazing in this film. She really but there's is. A lot of... And it has a lot to pack in only a 100-minute runtime, but it's able to kind of just explore all these different themes and plots and characters in such a compelling and rich way that you wouldn't even believe, like, yeah, you've been watching a 100-minute film. Like, you feel like it's... You're watching a 3-hour film given all the stuff that this film explores. Yeah,
but it doesn't feel like it's 3 hours. It does actually move at such a brisk pace. Like you're never sitting there bored. Like you're very invested and compelled into what you're seeing.
And it's interesting because watching this film, like I'm kind of interested to see like which this film is kind of inspired over the years because watching it, I couldn't help but pick up elements of Ken Russell's The Devils in this film.
You definitely get that. Like, I think in some part there would have been some kind of inspiration in some way, for sure.
Yeah, or even, like, most recently, Paul Verhoeven's Bernadetta. Like, I even got little shades of that in this film. Like, although those two films are far more extreme level compared to this one.
Yeah.
Interesting, Marcy, in the last half of this film, I even got, like, even shades of Dario Argento's Suspiria.
Yeah, absolutely. And just giving myself a little bit of a self-promotional plug, if you want to hear a discussion about The Devils and Benedetta, please check out After Dark with Super Marcy podcast, and you can look that up on your podcast player of choice.
Or even do it as a triple feature with this along with those other two.
You could. Yes, you could listen to that episode after this one.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great things about this film. Like I said, there's a lot of interesting characters, so many interesting and compelling themes and subtext to all of it that just make immerse you into the film. And it's just so beautifully shot. It's not to say the film doesn't have its flaws, like being that this is a film that was made in 1947. Like, even though there are a lot of Indian and South Asian actors in this film, particularly Sabu, who plays the young general in the film, there's about, I believe, from based on what I watched, there's about two actors who were obviously English actors down in brownface in the film.
Yeah, as well. So a little bit of a warning, if these things are quite sensitive to you, this might not be the film for you. It is quite obvious, like, that they did that, and this kind of stuff happened a lot. Like, honestly, doing that is only something that we haven't really seen too much in the last maybe 20 years or so. But that, yeah, you kind of get, like, yeah, it's an older film, and this is probably why, you know, I don't know if they couldn't get enough actors or they couldn't find the right people for it. But, yeah, there is a bit of that in there, and, yeah, it can be a little bit like, ew.
Yeah, I mean, definitely by today's standards, definitely ill. But at the same time, I can accept the fact that, you know, it's 1947. It's a different time. People didn't know better back then. So, I mean, it's definitely okay to criticize that type of stuff for sure.
Yeah.
But I think at the same time, we got to remember the context at the time when something like that, a decision like this was
made. Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that you actually, you know, it was, I think, two characters at least are more noticeable, like everyone else that you can see wasn't, and they were hopefully you know, at least cast from you know, for that area and stuff. So at least you know, a film went to some effort to do that, and even you know, a few years ago that wouldn't have been the case. So it says something, but yeah, I think that's probably like the only thing I could say is a flaw with this film, because I think everything is just so perfect with it.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think I'd sort of read up that it did win two Oscars, even though it was only nominated for two, and those were for Best Color Cinematography and Best Color Art Direction. And I gotta say, the movie deserves both awards on both counts, because the cinematography and art direction are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and the fact they had one for, because the color was still kind of coming into it during that time, like, yeah, it, the color use is just extraordinary in the film. Like, it's really, yeah, it's something special, this one.
Yeah, and I know recently, I think it might have been actually in 2020, there was a TV miniseries remake of Black Narcissus with Gemma Arterton in the Sister Clodagh role. And from what I read, like reading on the cast synopsis, there's definitely a lot of, I guess, more appropriate actors in some of the more Indian South Asian roles. So I think, which is a good thing. I mean, I'll be kind of curious to see how a three-part miniseries version of this story would do. But I think for what this film is, I think it's absolutely terrific. And I don't know about you, Marcy, and I got to say this because I only just remembered this just now. Because in the movie, Sister Ruth tries to profess her love for Mr. Dean, played by David Farrar. But he turns it down, says that he's not interested. Maybe it's just me, but I couldn't help but feel like, is it possible that Mr. Dean, the character, might have been gay?
I'm not sure, because you can definitely look at this film as being an erotic film without the visual eroticism. It's that repression that you see them feel, and then these tender moments between the characters, but then he kind of sort of doesn't want either of them, because you know that they're both kind of get this attachment, especially when you see kind of their last scenes with him. But you know what? It's very possible that could have been in there, and maybe we just never noticed.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting.
Or like, maybe Mr. Dean is just a butthole.
Yeah, well, that too. Like, I think there's a lot of things you can read into Mr. Dean. Like, it's possible that he could be, you know, a gay character, Or maybe he kind of respects that these women are nuns and they and sort of and doesn't want anything to do with them given their vows. Or he's just not interested in women at all. Or
he's just not interested in anything. He just is a loner, lives the hermit life.
Yeah. You know? And now that you say that there's a bit of eroticism in this film, Marcy, I sort of realize this movie is a little bit horny at times because there's a lot of very suggestive imagery throughout. And one in particular is when there's a character of Kanchi, and I probably butchered her name, so please forgive me, who's kind of this unruly village girl that the nuns take in. Of course, this played in brown face by Gene Simmons, just putting it out there. She has a run-in with the young general played by Sabu. There's a scene where she's on her knees in front of him, and it's very kind of suggestive.
Yes, it kind of takes you aback a little bit.
Given how close she is to his crotch.
Yeah, you're sort of like, oh, what's going on here?
And I was not expecting that in a film from 1947.
Yeah, I know, right?
But but that's the thing, though. There's a interesting underlying of sexuality in this film as well. But, you know, Powell and Pressburger, they kind of, yeah, I mean, a lot of certain moments are very suggestive, but they do it in a very subtle way that I guess for most people, they would, it just would not pop into their heads. But
yeah,
modern audiences like you and me, we pick up this stuff pretty easily, especially...
We're on the nose.
Exactly. Especially since you are the host of After Dark as well.
Exactly.
It's a very funny movie, this one.
Yeah, if films have taught me anything, it's that nuns are sexually repressed, and especially if there's isolation and stuff going on. So,
indeed.
Those poor nuns, they suffer.
Yes.
They suffer a lot. But ratings. What is your rating for Black Narcissus?
Well, it's just like The Black Coat's Daughter, Marcy. I'm giving this 5 stars as well out of 5. It's an absolutely fantastic film. I look forward to watching more Powell and Pressburger films. I mean, I think every single one that I've seen has been fantastic. I will have to give The Red Shoes a rewatch again very soon, for sure. But just pretty much everything I've seen has just been fantastic. And they really are up there as some of the best and most interesting filmmakers of all time. But especially around this period, because like a lot of their films like this or A Matter of Life and Death, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, or, you know, The Red Shoes are so ahead of their time in a lot of ways. So, I think it's a fantastic film that if people want to do, need another film to add to their The Devils and Bernadetta triple feature, add Black Narcissus in there as the kind of the warm-up to those two crazy insanity.
Yeah, for sure. My rating is also 5 out of 5. As I said, I think it's pretty much a perfect film. It's just there's so much about it that's just incredible. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. Like that third act is very confronting, and just the performances are incredible. Like, and just how it's shot, like, oh my god, it's so good. But that is our episode of Movie Swap, and that was a successful movie swap as we both really liked the films we gave each other.
Oh, definitely. And the fact that there were, and this wasn't until we actually paired the films together, that there were, I mean, other than being just religious themed, there were a lot of little similarities between the two of them. Like one being more, a drama and the other one a horror film. But, there's some interesting kind of elements that kind of link the two films together that I would have to say definitely do as a double feature.
Yeah, it definitely made for an interesting double feature because that's how I watched them.
Exactly. And I
needed to rewatch the movie I recommended, obviously.
Indeed. And I look forward to the next one because I think, Marcy, for our little movie swap episodes where we're doing every now and again, we are going to do, when we do our movie swaps, we're going to have specific themes centered around the films. Should we give our audience an idea of what they can expect next for our little movie swap episode?
Yeah, so you can expect a movie swap episode to drop on our YouTube channel, and you can look that up by looking up the Super Network. And as mentioned earlier, the episodes will be up a week early on Patreon, and it'll be in video format. So our next episode, which will probably be next month, Bede. Yes, tell everybody what the theme is, but we won't say what the film picks are in case we change our minds on those.
I think we're pretty secure what our picks are. Because
we'll keep it as a surprise for now.
We'll keep it as a surprise. I would definitely say, like, I could even say what just the what the where it's from, but I think I'm going to add a little thing to the...
okay.
A little bit more extra to it to give it a, even more of a special idea of what this film, this topic is. And that's going to be crazy genre mashup Hong Kong films.
Well, I wonder what we could have in store for each other, but you'll have to wait for the next episode to find out. So stay tuned. And as usual, thank you listeners for tuning in to the Super Podcast and all the podcasts on the Super Network if you regularly check them out as well. Be sure to leave us a 5-star rating if you want to give us a 5-star rating. Hopefully you do. As long as any reviews or comments you have, which you can leave on places like Apple iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcasts and Good Pods and Podchaser, I think is one of the other ones. So, yeah, please feel free to leave us a review and feedback. And, yeah, you can always catch us on the socials if you have any feedback on the shows. And we do like a bit of feedback and we do like to read them out on the shows. So you can always find the Super Network on Facebook with the Facebook page and group. And you can find all the information at supermarcy.com. And of course, you can look up the Super Podcast on your podcast player of choice, as we should be there, which has all the feeds to our many podcasts. And if you want to find us on the Twitter, it is SM_SuperNetwork. And if you want to find me personally on Twitter, it is supermarcy.com. And you can pretty much find me under Supermarcy on other things like Twitch and obviously After Dark with Supermarcy. And you can find me on the Letterboxd at super_Marcy. And Bede, where can people check you out?
Well, people want to find me personally. They can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BedeJamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BedeJamine. Or you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with all my reviews and columns.
Excellent. So until next time, find some decent friends so you don't need to get possessed by a demon, or just, you know, do your best to cope with severe loneliness if possible, and maybe don't try form a convent in the mountains, because I don't think it'll go well.
So, yeah, I mean, form one that's more close to the civilization rather than somewhere isolated in the mountains, just saying.
If you really need to form one. But yes, until next time, we've been the Super Network, Bede and Marcy signing off. Goodbye.
See you, everybody. Bye.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months.
please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. Surfy shark doo 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 doo.
And now back to the show.